Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Professor Robert English of USC, Professor Nigel Rabb of Loyola Marymount University, and a little bit later on in our broadcast, Art Sear of Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Our program tonight coming to you from our studios at Westwood One in beautiful Culver City, downtown Culver City, California, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv, and our website again, beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's @btbdumont. And tonight, for the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking more about what is happening with Vladimir Putin on the world stage, how the United States and how the allies are reacting to his aggressive action with Ukraine, and also the problems that are rising in Crimea. And we'll talk all about that, continuing a discussion that we began last week on this program. We had a good discussion last week, and we continue it this week. And also, I should mention to you that the other big story in the world today is the missing Malaysian airliner, missing with 231 people on board. We do know at this particular time there were two stolen passports involved in that. Whatever happened, they don't want to say it's a crash yet, but it is. They're suggesting that it might have just disintegrated at 35,000 feet. And so, if there's any breaking story on that during the course of our broadcast this evening, we will bring that to you and we will switch discussion to that subject. But again, we continue our discussion that we began last week. Nigel Rabb was on the phone last week visiting his home country of Canada. He's now back. He teaches at Loyola Marymount University, where he is also author of the book Democracy Burning, a Russian expert. And Nigel, let me begin with you by saying, what's the big development this week since we last spoke last week?
I think I would say that the big development this week is the setting of a date for a referendum that's coming up on Sunday the 16th. I think that is going to be the big turning point for Russia, for Ukraine, and for foreign policymakers.
Now, who will vote in that? And we also we're joined by Robert English and Professor English. Who will be able to vote in that? And some world leaders are saying that that's an illegal option, but it's being exercised anyway.
As far as I understand, those voting will be all citizens, adults in Crimea, in the Crimean Peninsula.
And they'll be able to vote whether or not they want to be part of Russia or part of Ukraine.
My understanding is that's how the question's being put. Mm-hmm. Would they prefer to remain as a region inside Ukraine or join with the Russian Federation?
Is there any standing? Has that happened before?
Referenda have happened many times. I guess the question you correctly raised is, is it legal? Is it constitutional? What procedures are following? Of course, the Ukrainian side says it's absolutely unconstitutional, mm-hmm. the way it's being done. And the Russian side says, you know, we've seen this before in Kosovo, for example, when the technicalities of a country's constitution or international law were ignored in a referendum and eventually secession mm-hmm. went forward. So both sides have their lawyers hard at work.
And what will happen? Let's talk about what happens now. What happens, first of all, who counts the votes? Who's going to count the votes, Nigel?
I would say in terms of the vote counting, one of the biggest difficulties is that the referendum is called within a week of a crisis. There's simply no time to
campaigning.
To let hotheads cool down or something like that. So I don't think anybody would expect that the outcome of the referendum is going to be upright and outright. I think there's a lot of suspicion about exactly counting
votes. And
Putin
would not have called for a referendum and moved it with this dispatch if he thought he was going to lose the referendum, right?
No, but I think the outcome is – I think we already know the outcome of the referendum.
Right.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I do think in terms of Putin calling it, the local government in the Crimean Peninsula did actually themselves vote in favor of joining Russia. Mm-hmm. And so –
And so if they did that, then that represents let's talk about the people of Crimea. Who are they? Again, the initial reports were these are the Russian-speaking, pro-Russian tend to be a little bit older, a little more conservative, a little remembering fondly the golden era of the Soviet Union. Have I summarized who this voting bloc is likely to be?
That makes up about 60%, my understanding, of the population of the Crimean mm-hmm. Peninsula. They're not all older, nostalgic for the Soviet days. There are, of course, younger Russians as well, who, for some of the same reasons and some different ones, perhaps the fears that their linguistic autonomy and other, you know, they have self-rule to a certain extent, certain cultural protections, and some of the proposals emanating from the new government in Kiev mm-hmm. would directly threaten some of those liberties and some of that self-rule. So even younger Russians there likely will vote, as their elders will, in favor of joining the Russian
Federation. Is there some validity to their fears? I mean, we don't know too much about the new government in Ukraine, but the things that they have done thus far, have they sent a signal that would warrant those in Crimea being upset and concerned about their future and security?
I would say that Moscow's portrayal of neo-fascists roaming the streets, an immediate threat to life and property, are grossly overstated. But at the same time, it is concerning that one of the first moves that the new government took, the new parliament in Kiev, was to vote to downgrade the status of the Russian language. And some of the other members of the new Ukrainian government are longtime, real right-wing, hardline Ukrainian nationalists who have a program. You know, they've been pretty open over the years about wanting to severely restrict Russian autonomy in Crimea. So they haven't taken concrete steps yet beyond that vote, which, in fact, the prime minister said he would veto. Mm-hmm. But to Russians, those are clear signals. If they're going to be this open about clamping down on Russian rights at this time, what are they going to do in 5-10 years when they've consolidated their rule in Kiev?
Is that a concern? Do you see that as a legitimate concern, Professor Reb?
I think when you look at the Crimean Peninsula, one of the things is that there are, I mean, as much as Russians make up 60% of the population, there's also, and I think we mentioned that last week, they're the Tatars. And so the Tatars are about 12%, and they generally will want to be part of Ukraine. That is in their interest. And you also get amongst the Russian population, because the Crimean Peninsula in the 1920s, it had autonomous status within the Soviet Union, or within the RSFSR and the Soviet Union. So it has always had a special relationship with Moscow. So you will get Russians in the Crimean Peninsula who are worried that they will lose power to Moscow.
Strategically, what is in that peninsula that makes it so vital?
Well, I would say very quickly two things. There's Sevastopol, the port. And the other one is, by taking over the Crimean Peninsula, they do actually extend their territorial waters in the Black Sea. And the Black Sea is
Russia is
hugely strategic for the transfer of natural resources.
And what can we say now about the military strength of Ukraine, Professor English? That's the question. We're gonna pause right now. I'm gonna give you 3 minutes to think of the answer. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. We're talking tonight about Russia, the future of Russia, and most importantly, when we come back, we'll continue our discussion and we'll ask the question: what, if anything, can the United States or leaders of Western Europe do to stop the move by Vladimir Putin? And let's get your response. 1-800-723-8029. When the president draws a line, does anybody listen? Back shortly. From Portland, Oregon to Pottstown, Pennsylvania, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's Great Talk radio stations, as well as Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Nice to have you with us. Before the break, I asked Robert English from USC about the military strength of We know that Russia has, obviously, is a strong military, but put it in comparison with what Ukraine might have to fight the Russians, although they seem to be a mismatch.
It is a mismatch in every category. Ships in the Black Sea, in those harbors, troops, artillery, aircraft, Russia has an advantage of 5, 7, 10 to 1. It's an overwhelming advantage in strength, but equally important is that Russia, for all practical purposes, already controls the Crimean Peninsula. The small Ukrainian units that are there are surrounded or emasculated. They don't have access to their ports or bases. So in some sense, if an annexation is going to be made complete, the military part is already well advanced.
And there really is no military option for the United States, is there, Professor Rob?
I would say no, simply because, I mean, the Crimean Peninsula, essentially, it is a peninsula, so there's an isthmus, but it's right next to Russia. So Russia's, and we saw that last week, they mobilized for their exercises 150,000 troops just for their exercises immediately. So Russia's right there. And, I mean, you can put the United States can put a ship or two in the Black Sea, but I don't see there's any.
You know, last week when you were a guest on this program, I asked, I'm always amused by and interested in timing as to why big things happen when they happen. And I put it in the context of the Olympics, and Putin was bogged down in the Olympics, and troops were, you know, were protecting Sochi, and maybe they couldn't have gone to the Ukraine to sort of put down the uprising, which turned into the ouster of the president. So I'm going to put the other question is, the leaders of Ukraine and the people that orchestrated the demonstrations in the street, and then there was the massacre of the 80 people by the troops, which again made people more excitable and brought about more people and led to the ouster of the Putin puppet there. My question would be, why would they push now, knowing that militarily they are far outmatched? Knowing, it seems to me. Well, I don't want to offer my own thought until I get yours, as to why do you think they did what they did now, knowing that maybe Putin's got an upper hand, and that maybe President Obama and Western Europe are not going to do much because they're beholden to Russia because they're a main supplier of oil and gas. So what card did they think they were playing, Professor English?
You know, this is a really good question, and I think we can go back to the 2008 war between Russia and Georgia for some insight. The president of Georgia at the time, Saakashvili, was in roughly a similar position. For years had been desperate, increasingly desperate, to regain control over two breakaway regions of Georgia that had large Russian, but other minority populations as well. And at the actual time the war broke out, Vladimir Putin and most world leaders were in Beijing for the Olympics. The American presidential campaign was coming close to the end. It looked pretty clear that Obama was going to win, 2008. And there's reason to believe that Saakashvili thought this is our last best chance. You know, Bush is still president. He's been a strong supporter. I can't possibly win this war with Russia. But they launched it anyway. They were the ones who escalated from intermittent sniping to, you know, all-out invasion first, knowing it would put them in a desperate situation that Russia would be counterattacking and hoping that NATO, the West, the Americans would come to their aid. Now, I'm not saying for sure this is exactly what's happening in Ukraine, but in the kind of post-revolutionary fervor in Kyiv, where a lot of extremists have now been sort of put in prominent positions, the passions are running high, and reason and, you know, calm deliberation isn't necessarily dominating, maybe something similar is the answer to your question. It's not the most rational decision. It's precipitative, but they're in the throes of passion.
Professor Rob, would you agree that it was maybe passion in the street as opposed to long-term political strategic thinking about how this is going to end up if we throw the rascal out? I mean, what do we do next?
I tend to think that if we put too much emphasis on the scheming of the politicians above, we lose sight of the fact that in the streets of Kyiv, they had tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands. And for me, looking at that, somebody who has studied civil society at length, it's very interesting because they were very, very well organized. This was not a mob, to use an older word. They were very prepared. They had shifts. They had food kitchens or food supplies. So it was very well organized. So I'm very wary to give too much to timing and too much to the Olympics.
No, but they were strategic and they were successful in throwing the rascal out, overturning the president that they wanted to go. But were there strategic thinkers, again, because of the getting back to what Professor English said, the passion can move a lot of people to do a lot of things. They can walk through walls. They can watch and see 80 of their countrymen slaughtered, and that only emboldens them. But it doesn't necessarily give them the vision to look around the corner and say, okay, all right, now we got the castle back. What do we do next? Is anyone in the world going to punish Putin? Is anybody going to stand up to him? Does the President of the United States, does he mean anything that he says? What about our friends in Western Europe? Are they gonna stab Putin in the back when they're waiting for the freighters of oil to show up to their shores? I mean, that's what's missing from this, as I see it.
Well, I would agree there was passion there, but I think when they were storming in the streets of Kiev when they got rid of Yanukovych, they weren't thinking that the Crimean Peninsula would be invaded. I mean, that's too strong a word, or mm-hmm. be occupied. So they weren't able to predict that. In the same way,
so they misread Putin.
Well, I also think that Putin himself could not predict the events that were happening in Ukraine over the last 3 months and the way those unfolded. So that in the inner circle in Moscow, and I think they would have preferred some type of stability with Yanukovych, in the inner circle, they were shocked by events and they were taken aback.
Professor English, you agree with that?
I do. a lot of people, and not necessarily well-informed, but excited and angry, have jumped to the conclusion that this is all unfolding by some long-term Kremlin plan, that Putin plays chess and we play poker, and it was all thought out in advance. And I don't think it was. Even really well-placed informed sources from Moscow, people with close ties to the defense and foreign policy establishment, reveal how little Russia was prepared for this, how they hope for a different outcome, how they've improvised along the way. And by the way, that leaves hope for a kind of compromise settlement, because if you're convinced that Putin was set on annexing the Crimea and maybe even more of Ukraine from day one, well, then it's pretty pessimistic. But if you understand that he's been improvising, he's been caught off guard, he's overreacted in this or that instance, then it leaves the door open for a compromise and some middle ground settlement.
What do we know now, based on what you've read thus far over the last several weeks? What do we know now about what our intelligence apparatus knew, what the CIA was reporting, or is this an example where we were flat-footed by what happened as well? Is there any preparation that the United States or the West could have done to put themselves in a better position than has been dealt to them now with Putin holding the cards and dealing the cards?
If I could answer that, I'd look at it from two ways. The first would be the Crimean Peninsula has been, I don't want to say in the exact same situation, but independence questions have gone on since 1991. And it's placed within Ukraine. This is not a new question. This has reappeared over and over again. So that is the one thing. And the second one is in terms of our own intelligence, similarly with Ukraine. I mean, Orange Revolution was 2004, 10 years ago. It has been a very, very, very rocky post-communist road in these places, so it's very difficult to predict in Ukraine.
I have nothing to add on what our intelligence agencies, what our best-informed analysts might have foreseen. All indications are, just from the way the government has reacted, that they were caught off guard as well, and they're improvising also.
Would you say that the rhetoric associated with the President of the United States talking about there will be a cost to be paid, there will be a cost to this, does the President's words mean anything to Vladimir Putin at all?
Sure they do. Both the specific threats, meaning the things we spoke about before, asset seizures, blocking of visas, and really trying to hurt Russia economically. But also the rhetoric. I think we underestimate how much it really stings, how much he takes personally. Comparisons, for example, to Hitler. Even if some of the tactics, we see some parallels between what Hitler or other aggressive dictators did, we might be a little more careful. This country, Russia, I mean, lost 28 million people to Hitler's forces in the Second World War. And there's just something that stings, that's almost unforgivable when their leaders are compared to Hitler. So we need to bear
that
in mind.
How likely would he respond to that? Because obviously Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, perhaps Democratic nominee for President of the United States, she's the one that first labeled him Adolf Hitler, referred to him as Adolf Hitler or Hitler-like. So what does that say about her use of language on the international stage? Is it a positive thing? Because, as you say, maybe it does get to his ego if it doesn't get to his military decisions.
First thing it says, she's running for president.
Yes, that's right.
It resonates. It's a popular thing to say. It reflects the anger and the incomprehension a lot of people have. But again, in a crisis, when we would both, when all sides would benefit from cooling the rhetoric a bit and searching, you know, reasonably, rationally for a compromise solution, too much of that doesn't help.
But also, we should mention that Putin is the one that is referring to the new leadership in Ukraine as fascists.
Yeah.
So he's using the red flag of fascism and Nazism as well.
The language is heated on all sides, overheated.
1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight, live from Culver City, California, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City. Thank you very much for joining us each and every Sunday night, and we hope that if this is the first time you've heard this program, we went on the air in 1980, so there's lots of catching up to do. But again, if you want to listen to old broadcasts, you can go to beyondthebeltway.com. There's a podcast that's available. There's past archives of the broadcast that are available. And we have been here every Sunday night, again, since 1980, talking about the events of the world and presenting opportunities for people that live beyond the Beltway to offer their perspective about what's happening in the world around us. And tonight we are blessed by having a couple of great guests in studio, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves. First of all, let's go to Nigel Rabb. Nigel, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you are and what you do, what you do.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Well, I wanted to just start by saying that I was born in Montreal, Quebec, and so when we're talking about the Crimean Peninsula and separatism, I am very familiar with that from my youth, as regularly in Quebec there are these referenda. Where I'm professor of Russian history at Loyola Marymount University. I did some of my graduate work in Zurich, beautiful Zurich, Switzerland, and then I went to Columbia University, where I studied civil society, which is these populist movements, as you might call them, in the Russian Empire and into the Soviet Union as well. And today I'm working on a project that looks at natural disasters and the social response to that.
And you wrote a book, Democracy Burning.
Democracy Burning, which is about urban volunteer associations in the late 19th century.
Okay. Robert English.
Bruce, thank you for having me as well. I teach at the University of Southern California. I direct the School of International Relations. I guess I started in the defense business. I went to undergrad, graduate school, did a different degree, and went straight into the Pentagon in the early 1980s, and then worked for the Committee for National Security. So most of the 80s in Washington, D.C., within the Beltway, I might add. But by that time, things were changing so rapidly in the old Soviet Union, and domestic politics were clearly driving foreign policy. So I wanted to understand Russia better and understand glasnost and perestroika and Gorbachev better. Mm-hmm. So that's when I went back to graduate school to pursue the doctorate, and since then have worked at the intersection of Russian domestic and foreign policy, always interested in how ideas, how the elites and the masses, how economics, how all of those impact a state's foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. If looking into the crystal ball ahead right now, if on the world stage it appears, let's say 3 weeks, 3 months from now, it appears that Vladimir Putin has gotten away with what he did, and there's no significant sanctions that have come from either the United States or its allies, what signal does that send to the rest of the world? And is there any other incursion that Putin might think of trying that he feels he could get away with if in his heart he feels he got away with what he's doing right now? Professor English.
I don't think that's possible. The first, you know, the scenario you laid out, should this turn into a full-blown and permanent annexation of Crimea by the Russian Federation? Of course, with the vote and so forth, support from the local population, but still against the will of the rest of Ukraine. I don't think it's possible going forward that there won't be really painful sanctions and punishing economic costs for Russia. That's not to say that your question still isn't a good one. What signal does that send? What does it mean for Russia in the future? And I would say this. Should this annexation proceed, Russia will swallow something that's going to be very hard to digest and will have so many local problems with Ukraine, probably see significant unrest, dissatisfaction, the growth of a more active civil society within its own country, not to speak of all the other, you know, neighbors and problems with countries abroad, that it'll be tied up and in difficulties for a long time. I think for Putin, the best outcome is some kind of compromise where they do not annex Ukraine but just maintain significant influence there. It's better for Russia to have this weak Ukraine and the leverage of a strong Russian population that supports it mm-hmm. within Ukraine, within Crimea, than try to take it over with all of its problems.
And what signal is it sending to the other former republics of the Soviet Union, Professor Raab?
Well, I think we discussed this last week. It's sending a very, very awkward signal to the other republics of the Soviet Union. And I think that's why, you know, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. It's a partner of NATO. And so the NATO members don't have a commitment to, I wouldn't say intervene, but even to sort of protect. Because in some of the other republics, the United States has actually been, you know, putting feelers out there just to make sure that Poland understands that as a member of NATO, it can get some help. I just wanted to, if I could add to the last question, I think there's annexing the Crimean Peninsula and annexing the Ukraine are vastly different. And so Crimean Peninsula is geographically, it is a peninsula, so it is separate. Whereas if you hear about the uprisings that are going on in the eastern parts of Ukraine in cities such as Kharkiv or Donetsk, these annexing these cities would be, I believe, a massive problem for the Russian Federation, and they would it would be much better for them to have those cities as part of a weak Ukraine, to agree with.
Because there is so much trade that goes on with American business and Russia today, I'm wondering how serious and how much teeth can be in any sanction that we impose. We forget about Western Europe, just us. How much of that pressure might be – how much pressure might be put on the United States and the president by U.S. business interests that are saying, wait a minute, slow down. I mean, it's hurting our business. We're ending up – I mean, it's the American, you know, love of the almighty dollar that may put pressure on our president to back off from some sort of an economic showdown. Professor English, is that within the realm of possibility?
It is. But again, everything that you describe is the same, only worse for Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get away from geography here, right? It just makes sense for them to do the trade they do with Russia, right? Which in this instance, we're mostly concerned about their dependence on Russia for 40-50%
right.
of their energy, their natural gas. There's no way that American, you know, shale gas from fracking, not even tomorrow, not even in 5 or 10 years, could come close to replacing that. Geography calls the shots here, right? The economies follow certain natural relationships based on where the resources are, the trade patterns. And so Western Europe will remain heavily entwined with Russia. It just makes sense.
I keep coming back to the question I asked in the last segment. The leadership that led to this overthrow, couldn't they figure this out? That when push comes to shove, you know, the people that are out there talking this great game about democracy, whether it's the United States or George Bush or Barack Obama or anybody in Western Europe, they're going to talk a good game. But when it comes to put up or shut up, they're not going to do much. They're like a paper tiger.
There is that problem. If I could come back.
But that is a real problem. That's not just my frustration describing
it,
right?
It is. And one of it is might even be said to say paper tigers, because each country, when you look at Europe, each single country has its own interests. So Germany, which is always a little bit weary about sanctions, is in a different position from France and England.
Right.
The United States is different again. If I could just – one little comment on the economy. Russia does today have a stock market. It did not have a stock market in the Soviet Union. And so earlier this week and ongoing, Putin has to be concerned about fluctuations in his own stock market.
No, I agree. The Russian economy can't – the Russian foreign policy establishment, Russian leaders can't undertake this or that international
adventure. Has there been an improvement? I mean, what's been the improvement in that stock market since this aggressive action?
No, not improvement.
No.
Collapse. It's lost
yes.
a lot of value.
And it's interesting too, because if you're watching it, it reacts to stability and instability. So – last, I think it was
like
Monday.
Like ours does.
Yeah, like ours does. So I mean, this is like last Monday, it went really down. And then Putin said, but there's not going to be – there's absolutely no need for military intervention. And then it stabilized again. And so I think what's important there's a force outside of the Kremlin that actually speaks volumes, even if it's an abstract thing like the stock market.
Putin is not an absolute dictator, and we forget that he is dependent on the goodwill, the support of a group of, we call them oligarchs often, extremely rich businessmen who enjoy these close relations with the Kremlin. Normally, we think about them as dependent on him, right? He can take away their companies. He can launch a prosecution at any moment. And so they have to stay in his good graces. But when their company's values are plummeting, because as you know, Professor Rob said, they're now publicly traded. They're on the stock market. Then the pressure goes the other direction. And they as a group are saying, hey, Vladimir, you're destroying us. Something's got to change. And that has to give him pause.
That sounds like another country I know. Very, very similar. Let's take a call. Let's go to Portland, Oregon, where Philip is listening. Go ahead, Philip, you're on the air.
Hello. There is something Obama can do. Very quietly send 500 Stinger missiles to the Ukraine.
What would the introduction of military hardware mean to this, in your view, Professor English?
I don't think that would be a good idea. We've been lucky so far that the confrontation, which could have turned violent at any moment, that an accident, a spark, some provocation could make it impossible to prevent something spinning out of control. We've been lucky that over these last few weeks it hasn't happened, but both sides are on sort of hair trigger alert. So sending, you know, military aid, sending something like Stinger missiles. In other words, the idea being that, what, the Ukrainians will start shooting down Russian aircraft. That would be intentionally putting a spark to the fuel.
A provocative act, to certainly, and feed the fear that many Russians have, is that the United States and the West somehow are, you know, in cahoots with Ukraine to strike as the way they've struck. Thanks very much for your call. We have more calls coming in. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about Russia, but we're also talking about the U.S. image on the world stage. And when we come back, I want to find out about Syria and what role Russia will continue to play in Syria and our involvement there. Back shortly. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont, live tonight from Culver City, California, Westwood One Studios. And Professor English, you wanted to make an added point about the Stinger missiles and Ukraine's ability to shoot down anyone that they want.
Yeah, what I had said was that I didn't think shooting each other's planes down is a good idea. What I might have added is that 5 or 6 years ago, I don't remember precisely, the Ukrainian Air Defense Forces, by mistake, shot down a Russian, I think it was a charter, a tourist airplane. It was carrying partygoers or vacation holidaymakers to the Black Sea area. So well, the main point here is Ukraine already has surface-to-air missiles. I think they're called SA-7s. They're from the old Soviet arsenal. They work perfectly well.
One other point that was made is that in this particular situation, it is not like many political battles that are out there where you have two sides, they're divided, they may be even, and one side hates the other or both sides hate each other. In this particular case, there is not a lot of hatred, or is there, Professor Rob?
I don't think there's a lot of hatred at all. And I think one of the ways to see...
Between the Russians and Ukraine.
Between Russians and Ukrainians because, for example, people make the point that... Despite the language issue that came up recently and the law they passed, which they revoked, in fact, Ukraine is a pretty bilingual place. Kiev, if you go to Kiev, is bilingual Ukrainian-Russian, and there's no problem with the two languages. And I think one of the big fears here is if it's over-militarized, you have two people who, yes, they have disagreements, and yes, every once in a while their administrative wishes differ, but there's just no reason for military conflict. And if we don't have calm, we will get that.
Let's go to Jeff listening to us on KTSM in El Paso, Texas. Always good to hear from Texas. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to say, I have a Russian wife, and I'm also a military veteran. And I know something about the Russian mindset and the people of Ukraine. Russia's not very good at invading other countries. You see what happened in the Soviet Union when they went into Afghanistan. They're defeated by a bunch of illiterate, poor sheep herders. And over 20 years, you still can't control Chechnya and Dagestan. So if they want to push it, and I think the Ukrainians, the people of Maidan, they got a lot of fight in them. And I don't think the Russian military wants to mess with that. And plus, also, I think Poland's going to jump in. They got a pretty big military nowadays. It's pretty technically advanced than it used to be. And also, I think the Czechs and the Hungarians and the Slovaks are going to jump in and help out Ukraine. So,
all right, good point.
Stay, he might get himself in a hornet's nest.
Stay on the line. Stay on the line because I want to get everybody's reset. We'll start with you, Professor Rabb. What about this powerful will to fight, and the Ukrainians are good fighters, and the Poles are fighters. I mean, all of those from the former Soviet Union, they're all strong, tough people and strong fighters. And the power and the will that goes into fighting for what you believe in is a pretty strong thing.
It's very strong. In Ukraine, it will differ as you move from west to east. So a city like Lviv in the west will have a different attitude from Donetsk in the east. The other thing which I want to add, I don't know if Professor English agrees with me, but Ukraine doesn't really have a steady government at the moment. It has a temporary government, which I actually think is performing very well. But the elections are coming up in May. So there are still these competing groups jockeying within Kyiv for influence. And so if a war were to break out, which I think would be an utter disaster, who's going to take charge?
Professor English.
No, I agree. I would only add to that something, you know, that you yourself said, Professor Rabb, when we were off the air, that these peoples, Ukrainians and Russians, are so similar, and their historical ties are so close, and they're mixed. I mean, the number of mixed marriages of Ukrainian husbands and Russian wives, or vice versa, children on both sides, a brother who works in Moscow, a sister who's in Kyiv, it's in the millions.
But to Jeff's point, if the leaders, the new leaders or the newly elected leaders in May, in Ukraine, if they were to reach out to the former Soviet members of the Soviet Union, including Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, which Jeff referred to, would there be a receptive ear there? Jeff seems to think there would be a receptive ear for, let's say, Poland to jump in to save their former Soviet, you know, colleagues. Not Soviet colleagues, but members of the Soviet Union.
I think I think Jeff's probably right about the nature of warfare, the weapons, the historical record. But in practice, if it came to that, I think it would be much messier. Let's go back to 99 when Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary joined NATO when they were officially admitted. In the Czech Republic, we had an interesting case where the leadership, right, Václav Havel was president, other very pro-European, pro-Western leaders of the Republic were pushing very strongly to join the European Union, to join NATO. The Czech people thought otherwise. They did not like this idea. All the opinion polls showed that they were very dubious about the military alliance, that they didn't want to get into it. And when, just months later, you remember, NATO went to war over Kosovo, over Serbia, mm-hmm. a number of prominent Czech officials spoke out, essentially saying, what the heck is going on? We signed up reluctantly to join a defensive alliance, and now it's on the offense. NATO is supposed to defend its territory against attackers, and we're bombing Serbia.
Jeff, 15 seconds. We'll give you a final word to you. You want to respond to any of that?
Yeah, I just want to say I think a lot of these, and I've got trained with them. I've trained with people all over the former Soviet Union, a lot of these guys. And I think they feel like their purpose in life is really to defend against another rise of Russian hegemony.
Okay. Good point. I appreciate your thank you for your service to the country. Thank you for your contribution to our broadcast this evening. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. 1-800-723-8289. Nigel Rabb from Loyola Marymount University and Robert English from USC, they join us. They'll be back for another full hour. After the news break, we will be joined by our good friend Art Sear from Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. 1-800-723-8289. Lots of people on the line. You'll all be on the air, and there's a lot more room for the callers that for our open phone line. So give us a call. 1-800-723-8289 from Culver City tonight. I'm Bruce Dumont, and this is Beyond the Beltway. Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Robert English from USC, Nigel Rabb from Loyola Marymount University, and joining us from his home in the North Shore of Chicago, from Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, Art Sear, the A.W. Clawson Professor of World Business at that great university. And our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289, coming to you from the Westwood One Studios in Culver City. Again, toll-free lines open, 1-800-723-8289. Our email address, btb@museum.tv. If you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it is beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to tweet us a comment, it's at BTB Dumont. And again, for those who may be new listeners to this broadcast, again, you can get past broadcasts and podcasts of the show. We've been saving it for many, many years. And one name that you will see on many of those programs over the last 20 years is Art Sear. Art Sear has been our go-to guy for foreign affairs and Russian-related matters for many, many years. Of course, we are doing this program now for the next couple of weeks in Los Angeles. Art is residing back in Chicago. And Art, we did not want this, as Rahm Emanuel once said, you never let a world crisis get away. And so we do not want to have this world crisis come and perhaps go before bringing you into conversation with our colleagues here in Los Angeles. But you've heard the first hour of the broadcast. You've been following the news, obviously, for the last several weeks, and certainly a scholar as our guests in Culver City are. What point would you like to make based on what you heard in that first hour? Are there things that you think need to be elaborated on or disagreed with?
Well, first, thank you for that, the invitation and that very gracious introduction. I must say you could be a diplomat, Bruce, perhaps perhaps ambassador to Ukraine or something like that. Just kidding.
I know. Me too.
I think very much that caution is in order. I think that one, I learned a lot from listening to you and your guests. I think one country that perhaps might be discussed more is Germany, especially because Chancellor Merkel has shown such great skill in a range of areas, including the interface between national security and economic dimensions. And she and Putin share a history in East Germany when they were young, when they were both young, doing very different, following very different career paths.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been in touch with him by phone at least three times in recent days.
What is she likely, what unique influence do you think she might have on him? Because we should also mention that, Germany is one of the major importers of Russian oil.
Yeah. Although the United States is becoming, with remarkable speed, a major producer of all kinds of petroleum products, I believe we have been for a while a net exporter of finished gasoline. And there might be more fluidity to that global market than there has been in the past. So I think Germany would have considerable freedom in squeezing the Russians if necessary because of the rapid growth of plentiful alternative fuel sources. Mind you, U.S. laws will have to be changed if we're going to become a more active exporter, but I would urge attention to that dimension.
Professor English, question to you, and that is during the break we talked briefly about the economic situation in Ukraine. How bad is it? And I know John Kerry was there with a check for $1 billion from U.S. taxpayers. Does that $1 billion, does that do anything to help this situation over there?
No, it was a nice drop in the Ukrainian bucket, a leaky bucket, mind you, but not much more. Ukraine is on the verge of default, right? They need a multi-billion-dollar infusion just to get through the next quarter, the next 6 months. And beyond that, a lot more aid. And to me, what's I'm glad we're talking about the economic side. What strikes me is that there's a real dilemma ahead, because even if the West, the Europeans and Americans, can come up with the $25-30 billion it will take for another year, year and a half of Ukrainian survival, they're not going to give it without some conditions attached, because otherwise it's just good money after bad.
Such as?
Such as an austerity budget. They've got to cut state spending. Such as freeing up domestic energy prices. Both Ukrainian consumers heating their houses and Ukrainian steel mills all get gas or other energy products at insanely low prices, which encourages waste, inefficiency. And this has been something that the IMF has been concerned about and insisting on for years. It'll have to happen.
If the new interim government and the one that is going to be elected in May goes through with some of these austerity programs that the IMF and Western Europe wants them to go through, how is that going to play with the population that has just overthrown one president? Is it likely for them to go to the streets again because they're not going to like the outside influence to save the economy because, again, they may not understand the world economic climate and the clout that these outside forces have on them? Professor Rob.
I think that's a great danger. I think if you look as a post-communist state, Poland and Ukraine in around 1991 started out at the same spot. Now, what are we at? 23 years later, the Polish economy is about three times larger than the Ukrainian economy. So the Ukrainians have been suffering through this for 20 years. And in terms of the patients—
corrupt or incompetent? Or just can't compete? What word would
compete.
You put on? Can't compete.
Can't compete at the
because
moment.
Of?
Corruption.
Corruption. Is that the common denominator in many of the breakaway republics?
Well, certainly in the Central Asian ones. That I think those might be the even more extreme examples. Not all. I think in the Baltic states, I think they've settled their economies more or less. But in Ukraine, yeah, the corruption is astronomical amongst all the politicians.
Is corruption, in your view, Art, is that a common denominator that's forcing or causing many of those people to head to the streets and just demand change?
Yeah, frustration in the specific case of Ukraine, luxurious living, which is in fairly recent months become public on the part of President Yanukovych and his cronies. But I think, again, your panel is getting at a very important point, about which Americans should feel very good. The rule of law, meaning our kind of due process, our kind of court system litigation, has been spreading remarkably broadly around the world, including to a degree in China, and very dramatically over the last quarter century in South Korea. And there are lots of other examples. The countries in Eastern Europe, which have done relatively well, have an economic infrastructure, but also, I think, a friendliness to the rule of law, notably Poland, but also countries like Hungary and the Czech Republic, which should make us as Americans all feel very proud. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of 1977, I don't want to get too academic or arcane, but that American legislation with the end of the Cold War, I believe, has been extremely important in this progress.
Insofar as the rule of law is concerned, if the United States and the West are singular in stating that they believe that Vladimir Putin is violating the Constitution of the Ukraine Constitution and violating international law, how does that fly in the face of a point of the Ukraine Constitution that allows a process of impeachment to get rid of a president, but that's not what the people in the street chose to do because I understand they didn't have the votes to do it.
No.
So is that not also unconstitutional? That's the question to everybody. Is that the violation of law that we should also be talking about in context with these other things? We're going to get the reaction from all of our professors who join us tonight on Beyond the Beltway, as well as we've got a full board of lights. We will hear from the people from coast to coast when we roll on from Culver City. I'm Bruce Dumont, tonight live from Beyond the Beltway. From Hollywood, California to Houston, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great radio stations. And mentioning Houston, I'm going to be heading down there this week for the big Houston Rodeo to get my jeans and my cowboy hat and my boots on and head down there. Going to see Keith Urban come Friday night, and I'll be back. I'll give you a complete report, and I will check my shoes and boots at the door before I come back here because I'm going to see a lot of livestock, and I'll bring back the flavor of the Houston Rodeo. I'm looking forward to it. We have lots of callers on the line. We're going to go to them in just a moment. But before the break, I asked everyone, and I'll let Professor English tackle it first, then get everybody's response to it, and that is, are are we talking out of both sides of our mouth in basically saying, okay, this is a violation of international law. You can't have this quick referendum because that's against the Constitution. And yet the Ukrainian Constitution has an impeachment provision in it that the people didn't follow. And so on one hand, I guess violating the Constitution is good for us. And the other point is that it's not good for us. So the law is a tricky thing. And which side would you like to argue, Professor English?
I'd like to argue the side that doesn't get too wrapped up in that, because it's a losing game. You're absolutely right. Technically, Putin's absolutely right that technically Yanukovych, under the provisions of the Ukrainian Constitution, remains president. He was not impeached by the sufficient margin of the parliament, and then it didn't go to the Constitutional Court, the Supreme Court, to fulfill its obligations in that process. He was simply chased out of town. Now, even Putin doesn't want Yanukovych back anymore, much less the Ukrainian people. Right. I'm just saying that it doesn't behoove us to get into a game of technicalities.
Would you agree with that, Art?
Yeah, I think Professor English makes a very good point. I think we can all stand by the American Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, especially the latter. People have a right to rebel, and we're doing better in the world because more and more people don't just accept authoritarian rule. I do think it's important. I must say I'm very impressed by Secretary of State Kerry's energy and focus on the details, as well as his daring in going to the scene of the action and trying to provide American leadership and largely succeeding. I don't think we should be lecturing everybody on the technicalities of the law, but we should be reminding people of the importance of international law.
All right, let's go to calls. Let's go to Robert, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio. Go ahead, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes. Ukraine gave up hundreds of nuclear weapons in 1994 for guarantees of territorial integrity, and somebody's going to have to step up and guarantee those, that agreement. I don't know if the U.S. or England, but everybody seems like they're scared of Mr. Putin.
Well, I think that's probably true. Professor Rob, would you like to elaborate on that?
The giving up of the weapons?
Yeah.
Or the
mm-hmm.
Well, I think we had the earlier caller who from Texas who was talking about the military will to fight amongst the Ukrainians. But I think everybody is hoping that this is not the issue at the moment. The issue at the moment is to prevent any possible conflict and to find a diplomatic solution. And then when Professor Sears talking about John Kerry's or Secretary of State Kerry's energy, I think that is what's important at the moment.
Mm-hmm. But also to go back to a point that a caller made in the last hour, and that is, could conceivably there be a time, again, we get past May, when there is a popular elected new leadership in Ukraine. And that leadership, again, tries to do some of the things that the IMF is asking for. And one of two things can happen. Either the people can get behind it and say, oh, for God's sake, let's throw these people out because they're not making life any better for us. But you made an interesting point during the break, Professor English, and that is in looking historically at the former Soviet bloc nations, the ones that have broken away since the fall of the wall, And there's a common denominator amongst those that have been successful and a common denominator of those against who have not been as successful, of which Ukraine is one as far as an economic and business economic power.
Yeah, what I was saying is that when you think historically, going back 20 years and the broad arc of attempted market transitions after communism, the most successful countries are also the most unified countries. Those that are lucky enough to have a homogeneous population. Look at Poland. It's been mentioned as this striking example of success. And Poland is, in the high 90s, ethnically Polish. They're all ethnically Polish, Catholic. There's a broad sense that we're all alike. We're all brothers. And what that means is that when you launch shock therapy, and the transition to a market has a lot of shock before the therapy kicks in, when the subsidies are cut, when unemployment goes up, when health benefits and social services and those protections are reduced, that shock is a lot easier to endure if there's the sense we're all in it together and we agree on the outcome, so let's pull through and bite the bullet. When a country like Ukraine, sadly, is deeply divided ethnically and in other ways, then immediately there's division. There's name-calling. There's a demand for a new election, a change of policy. And that's fatal.
Well, because the minority, which would be the Russians, there would be possibly a perception that they're on the short end of the stick.
Ukraine has two problems in this task. One is that many of the Russians just don't necessarily agree that the pain is worth it to join the European Union and go where the Western Ukrainians want to. The second problem I think you're pointing to is that when those austerity measures are implemented and the subsidies to inefficient business are cut, the unemployment is going to be a lot higher in the East than the West. That the impact of
the
this
Russians,
pain,
the Russian speaking sector,
yeah,
is going to carry,
is going to suffer more
of that,
and that'll only deepen the division and make it harder to power through. And yeah, it means maybe, as you said, the people might be back out in the streets.
Nigel,
I just wanted to add a point about Russia, the Russian Federation, in terms of its multi-ethnic composition, because we're talking about Ukraine as being a mix of Russians and Ukrainians. But if you go into the heartland of Russia, where you have Tatars, you have Bashkirs, you have all sorts of different ethnic groups. And I'm just thinking of the example of Kazan, which is about 500 miles east of Moscow. It's an oil-wealthy city, and it actually is a very good example of a Tatar population who lives together in relative freedom with a Russian population. They have issues, and they have had issues over the last 20 years, and they're actually relatively prosperous for a provincial Russian city. They're not doing that bad.
Mike in Fort Wayne, Indiana, listening to us on WOWO. Whoa, whoa. Go ahead. You're on the air, Indiana.
Oh, just another oil-rich region, ripe for the picking for the U.S. military, huh? With a history of Afghanistan, never did anything to America. Iraq, 9/11 report, had no responsibility for 9/11. What credibility, and I think zero, would America have with the defense contractors and the oil companies that are pushing? Let's get our foot in the door here. There's a lot of oil to be gained. What kind of credibility does America have? My God.
Just to make sure that I'm going to put a fine point on what you're suggesting. You're suggesting that the United States may be itching for some sort of a military involvement because then we could get some of the oil in Russia. Do you think that's what's behind all this?
Hey, since America was founded, invading the Red Man, we've always been a conqueror. When has America not went after the land and the natural resources?
Well, in this particular case, we're trying to figure out where there may be some sort of a military desire to do that, and there doesn't appear to be. I'm looking at my two professors that are before my eyes. They don't think much of that idea.
If I could just answer the credibility question, because the State Department, the American State Department, they put out the 10 lies that Vladimir Putin told, mm-hmm. and it's actually pretty – those are strong words to say that Putin was lying and have it on the State Department. Yes, have it on the State Department website. The Russian Foreign Ministry responded, and the Russian Foreign Ministry responded with this question of credibility, and it brought up all the wars that America's been involved in and the idea of does this fit the rule of law. We don't have to believe the Russian Foreign Ministry, but that is their response. And you can actually, if you're interested, you can go to the Russian Foreign Ministry website. It's in English, and you can look at much of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Virginia, where Joe is listening to us on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me on tonight. I just, I'm wondering what the Olympics in Sochi, what kind of effect they had on Putin and giving him maybe some of the boldness that he has had in placing his troops and really trying to annex Crimea.
Nigel, we talked about that briefly last week. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on Sochi and the role of the Olympics?
I think the role of the Olympics is a part of a broader global phenomenon, which is the reemergence of Russia in a sense that Russia is back. I actually don't think it's necessarily connected with what happened to the Crimean Peninsula.
Art, is there a possibility that the Soviet Union could get back together again?
No, I don't think so. I do want to underscore the importance of your other panelists' comments about ethnic tensions and ethnic diversity. Putin is worried all the time about the enormous and rather volatile mix of nationalities in Russia, to say nothing of the former Soviet Union. And he's worked very hard to keep a lid on things. the current leader in Chechnya, Kadyrov, was he and his father, who was assassinated, were important separatist leaders. And it's evidence of Putin's effectiveness and skill when he wants to show, to demonstrate that, that he's been able to bring Kadyrov around and essentially put a damper on Chechnya. But he must be worried about this constantly, and that's congruent with deeply historically rooted Russian anxieties about the buffer on their western border. I mean, this kind of thing goes back hundreds of years, greatly reinforced by Napoleon's invasion and capture of Moscow, and it became paranoia during the total, terribly brutal death struggle with Nazi Germany.
Art, we've got a pause. That was Art Sear, the director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business. That's at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's been at Carthage since 1998. Also, we should mention, a graduate of UCLA and Hollywood High. And we'll see you back in Chicago in a couple of weeks, Art. Thanks for being with us tonight. I'm Bruce Dumont. We will continue from Culver City in a couple of minutes. From Palm Beach, Florida to Palm Springs, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. Our guests in studio this evening are Robert English. He is an associate professor and director of the International Relations Department at the University of Southern California. He's also author of a number of books, or contributor to some books. So give us some of the books that you have contributed to, author, Mr. English.
I would mention first the Russia and the Idea of the West, which had the subtitle Gorbachev, Intellectuals, and the End of the Cold War. And this was my big study of how post-Stalin domestic and intellectual changes built up over 20, 30 years within the system a strong, coherent group of Western-looking, liberal-leaning, reform-desiring members of the party, members of academia, and other walks of life, scientists, who were there ready and waiting when Gorbachev came to power in 1985 and the country was becoming an economic basket case. They surrounded him, they convinced him, and helped accelerate his already modest reformist intentions to where, in short order, he democratized the country and ended the Cold War.
And from 1982 to 1987, you were a policy analyst at the Department of Defense and also the Committee on National Security. And Nigel Rabb also joins us, a PhD, and he is an associate professor of Russian history at Loyola Marymount University, author of Democracy Burning, 8 years at Loyola Marymount. And again, you have been to Ukraine, you've been to Russia, you have been to Kiev. You were describing Kiev for us. Describe that to the audience. Is it some backward city, or is it modern?
Kiev is a beautiful modern city. I lived there for 3 months. I lived right in the center of the city, probably about a 5-minute walk from where most of these demonstrations took place. It has a Soviet facade to it because they did a lot of Soviet renovations in the middle of the 20th century. And I also took the train one night, to an overnight train, to go to Lviv or Lvov or Lemberg, depending whose side you're on when you say the word. The city in the West, which is very, very pro-West and very pro-Ukrainian. And I can remember being in the train in the middle of the night, and this is a bunk train, and you say, you know, good night to the other Ukrainians there. And I said, see you in Lvov. And they all immediately piped up and corrected me and said, see you in Lviv, because this was not the way to call the city, according to them. So I was in Lvov. It's a beautiful city. It has this Habsburg flavor to it from the 19th century. So
when Art Sear was on, I neglected to ask him the question, because he is author of the book After the Cold War. The use of the term Cold War, is it too early to suggest that we may be moving into a Cold War mindset, Professor English?
I think it's too early.
It still possible?
It's still possible, definitely. I mean, we're certainly on that trajectory. Mm-hmm. So pessimists could say we're rapidly heading in that direction. But I remain cautiously optimistic that cooler heads will prevail and some kind of compromise settlement will come out of this Crimean crisis, and then we can step back. And the good thing about Americans is we have short memories. We're forgiving. Mm-hmm. We're all about business. And if things are going well now, we put the past behind us pretty quickly.
And not so many months ago, there were people that were suggesting that Vladimir Putin might get the Nobel Peace Prize. He might have been the Person of the Year by Time magazine. And yet now he's considered sort of a bad guy, at least on the world stage. Yet he doesn't seem to care too much about it. But we read how much money he poured into the Olympics to beef himself up. How would you, if you were to try to get inside his mind, what sort of a mind would we find? Is he an egomaniac? Is he smart? Is he shrewd? Is he brutal? Is he cruel? Or is he brilliant?
I'm not sure I'd say brilliant, but he's definitely very smart, and all the other adjectives you used, cunning, shrewd, calculating, can be brutal when necessary. That's all true. I think we underestimate him if we just think he's sort of out of touch with reality, unhinged. We've heard that recently. Then we underestimate...
Or an Adolf Hitler?
Or a Hitler, yes. He's a great power Russian leader, and as Professor Robb said, one of his missions, his central mission, has been to restore Russian greatness. He's not a Democrat at heart, but he has to understand and does understand that there are now markets that Russia is tied to, that it's not an autonomous country as it was during the Cold War, and has to, in the long run, have good trade and other relations with the outside world, with the West.
Within the Russian people, how do they view this action that Vladimir Putin is taking on top of the Olympics? Professor Redd.
One of the most remarkable things about Putin over the last, I guess it's now 14 years since he became president, is his popularity ratings are utterly astronomical. I think now they're around 60, low 60s, and for him this is very low. And so there is a little bit of a downtick, but I think generally speaking, I mean, as somebody else has said, he's the only show in town, so he actually is very popular. In terms of over the long haul, if you look at the last elections, his popularity in terms of the voting, it did tick down a little bit, so it's difficult to tell what this little incident will
Is he the most powerful leader in the world today, Professor Ram?
I don't think so. I think I would agree with what Professor English said earlier, is that he at home is very, very tied to a lot of different forces. Like, they're the oligarchs. There's the stock market we mentioned. So there's all this going on. I mean, I think the president of the United States is still the most powerful president in the world. And if I could add just about the question on the Cold War quickly, I don't think we'll get back to a Cold War. Russia has 150 million people. That's about 11% of China. And we've seen over the last 10 years the reemergence of China. What I think will happen is that we're going to have this multipolar world of, you know, multi-powers, and Russia might be one of them.
Would you agree that the President of the United States is the most powerful man in the world, Professor English?
I would. He has more military might at his disposal. If we just think of it in terms of what damage can he do, what influence can he extend, exercise in the world, he's the one.
Are you disappointed that his words don't seem to make anyone shudder?
I think they do.
They do.
I think over time, I think we get a little, in our domestic American debates, a little overheated if we don't see immediate results, or if he unfortunately talks about a red line, you know, and then someone crosses it and there's not immediate consequences. We sort of have a kind of cowboy mentality. But in the long
Perhaps he shouldn't say it then.
Perhaps he shouldn't say it.
If he doesn't mean it.
I just don't think that in the long run, America's credibility and America's might depends on the way we the snap judgments we make and the dissatisfaction if we don't have instant results that we seem to emphasize in our discussions here at home. The rest of the world respects and fears the United States greatly.
Joe, let's go to you, listening to us in upstate New York. Where are you calling from, Joe?
Waynesburg, New York, actually, upstate New York, rural area.
Is that in the Finger Lakes?
By the way, I want to say your program is excellent, and the discussion I've listened to so far is very, very good. So,
thank you very much.
I have a two-part question, and it's real short. The first one is, it's more of a global question for these gentlemen. I think they can answer it. Don't you think that and how do you think this is true, that the influence that he touched on a minute ago, how we could influence our potential enemies like Russia or China or anybody that comes along, whether it be Iran, by our strength, economic strength, and our financial strength. And that is very, very important that we take that into consideration before we try and assert ourselves militarily. And I don't care whether you come from the left perspective or the right on that. And the second question is, would we be better off doing what we did before we entered into free trade, like Ross Perot said, and have a strong economy with lots of jobs and lots of patents if we went back to that, and even in a small way, and had an equal trade? Or does he think that would be good for us to do it before we assert ourselves on the world?
All right, let's let Professor Rabb tackle that question. Pick either question and tackle it.
I think I'd tackle the first question about influence through economic strength. I think that is very important, and I mentioned the stock market earlier. The only limitation I'd see on that is traditionally, if you look at the Russian population, say, through the 19th and 20th centuries, the government has always been willing to allow its peasants, its workers, to subsist on very, very meager wages so that it could pursue its military ambitions. So having a poor economy in the countryside has never really bothered people like Stalin or whatnot. So, mm-hmm.
Professor English?
On the second question of, if I understood correctly, following the advice of Ross Perot and kind of going back to what, a less globally dependent, more manufacturing mm-hmm. and factory jobs at home.
America first.
I don't know how we get there. It's too late. We're just too dependent. I mean, as you probably know, without Chinese investment in our economy and purchases of our debt, we'd be in big trouble. Without Chinese consumers buying what we export, the same thing, and we can multiply that all around the world. American businesses, to stay competitive, they have no choice but to go where the costs are lower. So we export jobs. We need to replace factory manufacturing jobs that are lost either with new high-tech industries or whatever services and others to keep our engine running here. But I don't see a return to the sort of post-war 1950s boom as possible.
What does China observing right now on the world stage, Nigel?
That is a very difficult question for me to ask as a non-China expert.
Do they want to see Russia pumped up? I mean, do they want to see this resurgence of Russia and Putin as a world leader, or are they?
Well, given all the,
I don't think they're threatened by anything, but are they concerned by that?
Given all the conflicts throughout the Cold War between Russia and China, I would say they don't want to pumped up Russia. And the other one is, if you think of the southern borders of Siberia, which are near China, they're facing a growing Chinese population that is looking at all this empty land to the north.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Chechnya. We hear about it periodically. It usually is as a result of some act of terrorism that has taken place. We know that it's something that concerns Vladimir Putin, and should it concern us? That question when we come back. From Spokane, Washington to Salisbury, North Carolina, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Before the break, I threw up the question of Chechnya. We hear about it periodically, and there was certainly fear of Chechen rebels or terrorists disrupting the Olympics. The Olympics came and went without any significant disruption, at least of the games themselves. What should we as Americans know? If we knew three things about the Chechens, what should we know, Nigel? What are the things that we as Americans should know and care about?
Well, the one thing in terms of the conflict, it's within the borders of the Russian Federation. So this is not the same thing as the Crimean Peninsula, which is outside the borders. The second one I would say is this is a long-standing conflict. So that Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist in the middle of the 19th century, writes Haji Murat, which takes place in the Caucasus region. So that would be the second thing. And the third thing I would say is this, the wars in the Yeltsin years, and that they're with Boris Yeltsin, not Putin. Mm. And
but
Putin
again, in this particular case, with Chechens, we know that they are a significant thorn in the side of Putin. They hate Vladimir Putin. At the moment, a lot of Americans don't really like Vladimir Putin. But is there any reason why we should be cheering for the Chechens in their constant threat to Vladimir Putin? Because he seems to be more worried about them than he does any outside source, because they have weapons, they have demonstrated those weapons, and they, more than any other entity in the world, can create havoc within Moscow, within Russia, and cause more political harm to Vladimir Putin than anything the President of the United States says.
I don't know that I would be cheering for either side. They're both bad guys.
Okay,
more
that's
than
good
guys.
Know.
the thing that I would add, the fourth point I would add to the previous three about Chechnya is actually to expand the problem. Chechnya is one of a number of republics of the Russian Federation in this Caucasus region that are all racked by instability and insurrection. There is Dagestan, there's Ingushetia, there's North Ossetia, Kabardino-Balkaria, Bashkir, and on and on. And most of them have Muslim majorities. Most of them have been mistreated or neglected through the Russian, imperial, and later Soviet decades, and are filled with insurrection, which has become more radical with the arrival of sort of fundamentalist Islam. We don't like the brutal ways that Putin has sought to repress them. But again, that goes back to Yeltsin, it was noted. But neither do we like the extremist sort of retrograde kind of states and policies that those movements would impose if they won.
Because they have so much and demonstrated so much power insofar as spreading fear and terrorism, and they really do scare the bejesus out of Putin. And as one of our callers earlier suggested, that maybe if Ukraine gets their back up and they reach out to Poland and Yugoslavia and Hungary and some of these other former Soviet states, maybe their coalition has nothing to do with the West. Their coalition is groups and countries that have a similar hatred, singular hatred, a common denominator being Putin. We're going to take him down. And we know that they're great fighters, and we know that they will risk nothing to get their way because they've engaged in terrorism. Do they represent the threat of a possible Third World War? Professor Rapp, you want to take that? And what I'm thinking is, we go back to World War One. You know, there was a little incident halfway mm-hmm. around the world that nobody in the United States knew anything about, and it led to World War One because Archduke Ferdinand got assassinated. Is there something like this that's brewing out there that could take what we're talking about tonight and blow it up into World War III?
I don't think so. If it is, I don't think it would be with Chechnya. If it were to be, I don't think it would be with the Crimean Peninsula either. I think it would be with Putin having his eyes on the big industrial cities in the eastern parts of Ukraine, such as Donetsk or Kharkiv, because I think Crimean Peninsula is geographically separate, whereas it could trigger something much, much larger because these cities are right near the Russian border. If there was a Russian invasion or a Russian seizure of these cities in the same spirit that was done on the Crimean Peninsula.
But is there a seething attitude out there amongst the Chechens and about others? Whose hatred for Putin is so strong that, again, maybe they're not doing anything rationally. They may not be thinking around the corner, but could it lead to the type of domino effect that leads that takes this already combustible situation and blows it up, Professor English?
I don't think so, because they also have grievances with each other and major beefs that would divide them as much as unite them. And they might dislike Vladimir Putin, but for different reasons. And so if the Chechens got what they wanted, it would infuriate some other group. It would actually sow dissension among those who might share a common distaste or suspicion of Russia right now.
But this circumstance that we began the broadcast with this evening, which, again, we don't know much about at the moment, which is why we haven't talked about it, and that is the missing Malaysian jet. And it's known that there are two false passports that were on there, 231 people lost, no sign of what happened to them as of this moment before we go off the air. Things like that not only scare us as Americans, but these are the type of things that can scare Vladimir Putin as well.
Absolutely. And I think that's where he's concerned about extremism in Moscow. And that was one of the concerns he had when he saw the events in Ukraine. There was a legitimate concern that they would run out of control. And that what would he do?
On that note, we want to thank that was Nigel Rapp, PhD, Associate Professor for Russian Studies and History at Loyola Marymount University. Professor, thank you for being with us tonight and last week as well.
Thank you.
Professor Robert English has also joined us. He is an Associate Professor and Director of International Relations at the University of Southern California, and we thank you very much for being a guest this evening.
It
and
was
our good
great
friend
to be
Art
here.
Sear joining us for a portion of our broadcast this evening from Carthage College. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio and Westwood. Westwood One this evening. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz back in Chicago and Ted Woods and Corey Irwin for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from California.